just arbitrarily harassed and detained this individual. So this is why we're crying. Please don't deport these people, because these conditions, the conditions back home are terrible. But, you know, we stand, you know, our prayers goes out to those people who were deported. We don't even know if they are still alive today. And so we're really pleading that don't deport these people, because they are going to be, you know, treated as such. So this protection doesn't apply to those people, but only for those who are still here, those who are present in the United States as of the date of designation.
Ukrainians were granted temporary protected status, what, the 30,000 living in the United States, about a week after Russia invaded. You have been fighting for this for years for Cameroonians. Talk about what they face at home.
So, Cameroon, we've been fighting for this for so many years, like you mentioned. Other advocates have been fighting for as long as 6 years. The Cameroon Advocacy Network, which was founded last year under the Haitian Bridge Alliance and partnership with other human rights
support
organizations.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Kansas City Museum, located at 3218 Gladstone Boulevard in the historic Northeast. The new Kansas City Museum is now open, featuring exhibits, programs, and experiences encompassing Kansas City's past, present, and future. You can find a full list of events as well as ways to support the museum, all at kansascitymuseum.org.
National Volunteer Week is an opportunity to recognize the impact of volunteer service and the power of volunteers to tackle society's greatest challenges. At KKFI, we are fortunate to have a group of volunteers who have accepted this challenge, which is expressed by our mission, in part, to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Thank you to all of the volunteers who make KKFI happen. We appreciate everything you do this week and every week of the year.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Today, host David Bell speaks with Rika Sharma Crawford, attorney and author. She's an immigration attorney and partner in the Kansas City law firm Sharma Crawford Attorneys at Law. Sharma is nationally recognized for her expertise. In 2021, she was nationally recognized by the American Immigration Lawyers Association. In 2018, the Kansas Bar Association honored Sharma Crawford with the Courageous Attorney Award. In 2017, the Missouri Bar Association honored Sharma Crawford and her law partner with its Pro Bono Publico Award. Along with having several critical published court's decisions, Sharma Crawford is also an author and speaker on issues involving immigration law and policy. And now she's written a book, Alia the Brave, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement, is a children's book designed as a resource that helps readers understand the impact immigration enforcement can have on children and what emotions children may feel in the aftermath. In 2012, Sharma Crawford and her husband, who is also her law partner, founded a nonprofit law clinic to provide representation for indigent individuals facing removal in the Kansas City Immigration Court. The clinic at Sharma Crawford has helped thousands of clients and for nearly a decade has provided much-needed pro bono and pro bono representation. We'll play our calendar at the midpoint of the hour. On Jaws of Justice, we examine how to find justice in our society. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
Hi, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. On today's show, and in a few episodes that will follow, we're going to talk about trauma. You know, in Saturday's New York Times, just by chance, I came across an article of a drone operator who suffered from significant trauma for the work that this person did. And what was I found fascinating about it was, of course, this drone operator sat in a what was described almost as a metal shipping container from thousands of miles away, and would study and watch targets and eventually be instructed to send bombs to rain down on those targets. And at the end of the article, it became apparent, and it was actually stated, that the person doing that, although they had watched these targets for months to track them down, got to know them, if you will, and then caused such destruction, that those individuals in our military are not considered combatants. And so as a result of that, there is no, or at least there wasn't, per this article, really any type of services offered. And then the article goes on to talk about how that trauma manifested itself, at least in this service person's life. You know, in the criminal justice system and the immigration system, we see trauma happen all the time. And what I'd ask you to think about as we go through this episode, the next few episodes, is how trauma manifests itself. With whom does it manifest itself? How is it spread across the system? How do we identify it? How do we capture it? How do we calculate the impact? So that when all is said and done, when we decide to pass laws, decide to enforce certain parameters of those laws, that we do so with the full knowledge of the impact. With that, I want to welcome to our show a guest that we've had before, Rekha Sharma Crawford. She is a brilliant immigration attorney, a fighter, just an amazing intellect in this area. But she's done something slightly different here, and I want to talk to her about it. She's written a book, and a book specifically from the perspective of a child and about trauma. And so we're going to use this book as a springboard, if you will, as we go through this episode today and the few that follow. And with that, I will welcome Rekha Sharma Crawford to the show. Rekha, thank you for being here.
Good morning, David. Thank you.
If you could briefly talk about, I know people know who you are, at least most of my listeners would know who you are, but if you could just briefly talk about what you do generally. You know, you're an immigration attorney, but there are different types. And then we'll talk about the book.
So my practice is about family-based immigration. It is also naturalization. And then more importantly, it's about removal defense. So we represent individuals who have some form of immigration enforcement occur in their life. And as a result, they are going through the immigration court system.
And so I know, and I've worked with you in the past, with your clinic and also on the private side, and I see pain and suffering, if you will, particularly in the faces of families and individuals going through the process. But you decided to write a book about it. And I was wondering if you could talk about kind of what prompted that and then how you came about focusing on the perspective of the child.
You know, I found that, I used to be a former assistant district attorney in a lifetime that feels much, much long ago now. But what I knew is that at least from the prosecution's perspective, there were resources that were available to child victims, that there were victim coordinators that would work specifically, therapists that would work specifically with children who themselves were either going through the system or they had family members going through the system. But when I shifted over to immigration court and even federal district court on immigration litigation, what I found was that there were no resources available for children at all. No one was talking about what happens to kids who have family members, in particular parents, who are forcibly removed from the house in the early morning hours of a given day. And as part of immigration enforcement, I actually started thinking about and writing this in my head years before it actually came into being. And what I saw is that you would hear about, you know, raids and kids who were at home, and we would hear family members tell us about, you know, immigration came to their house early in the morning. They were still in their night clothes, the kids had not even woken up or brushed their teeth, and one or more of the family members were being taken out of the house. On a grand scale, if you remember back when they did the Postville raids in Iowa, and you had stories of kids that were coming home from school and mom and dad were no longer there. And this was real trauma that no one really was addressing or even talking about. And so that's kind of what led to me looking at this as a resource and creating a resource for families, but also therapists and teachers and social workers and attorneys to be able to use it as a way to start a conversation about some of these hard topics.
You know, when you and I were talking before, you had brought up something that I remembered. I think it was during Attorney General Janet Reno's tenure. And it was a young boy that was taken, I thought, from a parent's one parent's house and sent to Cuba, or returned to Cuba, however the phrase may be. I wonder if you could talk about that, in particular the image that came to mind as you thought about writing this book.
Yeah, so over and over again, and I'm old enough now to remember the Elian Gonzalez case out of Miami, and while the facts and things, the legal issues there are not really pertinent to what I was looking at in terms of this book, what visual kept coming back to me is that visual of that child being held at gunpoint. Right. You had ICE and you had the gun in the child's face. And I think anybody who was around at that time or even aware of the global issues that were going on at that point, if you close your eyes and I say Elian Gonzalez, that's one of the very first photographs or pictures or visuals that people come up with. And if it is that tangible to us adults, imagine the trauma that occurred to that child. And I think that's the issue is that if you look at it, we can all recognize it. We can all process it. We can even go, here's what was happening. But for that child in that moment, there really isn't a way, an effective way for that child to address it. And nobody talks about it. No one talks about, you know, you had a parent taken out and all of a sudden the kid's in school and is displaying behavioral issues that all of a sudden we don't understand why it's occurring. We talk about it in the criminal justice system. We talk about it a lot in the family court system, right? The family court attorneys are very, very aware of and receptive to understanding that kids of divorce are going through these issues. We just don't talk about it in the enforcement side for immigration.
And so you had an option, if you will, a number of options, I would think, on how to write this book. It could have been a manual for professionals. It could have been a CLE for attorneys. It could have been an instruction booklet. But you chose to write it from a specific point of view. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about that point of view and why you chose that point of view.
I wanted it, first and foremost, to be a tool that kids could use. That, you know, adults can, we have the resources, we have the cognitive ability, but oftentimes kids don't understand what it is that they're feeling or what it is that they're going through. And I wanted to have a product or a resource that people could use to start the conversation. In my work, I know that when we're dealing with non-citizens, so many of them won't even talk about what's happening to their children. So we'll say, look, we need your kids to come to court. And they're like, no, our kids don't even know what's happening. Kids are smart. They know what's happening, right? They can pick it up in what's happening in the house. They can pick it up with the way that the parents are talking. They can pick it up by the way that people are reacting within the house. And I wanted them to be able to put some kind of an emotional understanding to it. And so that's why I wrote it from the perspective of the child. And when I did, I wanted that child to be every child. And there was a particular reason that I picked the name that I did and told the story in the way that I did. Again, you know, I kind of thought about these things for a very long time before I started writing. And part of what I wanted is I wanted it to be, when I think of great storytellers for children, I think of Disney. I think of Pixar, right? They take on really hard topics and make them and tell those stories in a very relatable way, whether you're an adult or whether you're a child. And that was kind of my goal, is I wanted to do it from the perspective of the child, and I wanted it to be relatable not only to the child, but also the adults in the child's life.
So let's talk about some aspects of the book. First of all, the name of the protagonist, if you will, the main character, it's spelled A-A-L-I-Y-A-H. How do you pronounce that name?
Alia.
Alia, and it's Alia the Brave, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement. That's the title of the book. Let's talk about why you chose the name Alia. Why that name versus an infinite number of other names that are out there?
So Alia, in its alliterations, it shows up in a variety of cultures. It shows up as a name with different although I say Alia because in the Indian culture it's Alia, but in other cultures it can be Alia. And I've had someone ask me, well, I pronounce it Alia. Doesn't matter. Pronounce it how you will. That was the whole point of her, is that pronounce it in the way that your culture recognizes, or the child's immigrant culture recognizes, because it's about representation. It's about being relatable. I thought when in talking to people, someone said, well, why don't you make it just a normal name that everyone can pronounce? Because an immigrant experience isn't like that, right? It's about not being able to see yourself in so many other mediums. You don't see, you're starting to now see brown people on TV. But you know, you never, when I was growing up, there were no Indians on television, right? No, if 30 years ago you said Priyanka Chopra, no one knew who that was. All of a sudden, Priyanka Chopra, everyone knows, right? And so it's about representation. So I picked a name that was universal. You find it in the Hispanic culture. You find it in the Persian culture, the Islamic culture, the Hebrew culture. I mean, you just find it in so many ways. That was part one. Part two is I love the meaning of the word. The meaning means rising. And for me, that's exactly what this character was all about. It was about rising to address some of these issues that no one was talking about.
And you, the title of the book is Alia the Brave. I'm curious, you know, every part of the book that I've read, and it's just a beautiful book, is intentional from the name, but also now the description, the brave. I'm wondering what bravery means to you, at least in the context of this book.
I mean, bravery to me, I used that for two reasons, and it has two separate meanings. Alia, I needed her as a character to be brave, to be able to understand what's happening in her life. But I also wanted her parents and her community and her teachers to be brave, to be able to address and talk about a topic that, much like immigrant communities, ends up in the shadows. And it takes bravery. It takes courage to come out from under the shadows. It takes lawmakers and politicians and those in power to be able to be brave to take on the issue of immigration. You know, immigration, anytime you say the word, people kind of shun away from it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to understand the human aspects of it. It's easier to use it to divide. And I think in my selection of that particular adjective, it was designed to say, look, it's going to take a certain amount of bravery on all levels for us to deal with what's being done to these kids.
And the second part of the title, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement. How is this tool, this book, a children's book, how does it empower children? What is empowering about seeing your story, if you will, in front of you?
I think it takes away the loneliness. Children of families who are accustomed to living in the shadows are all about secrets. They can't tell people they're undocumented. They can't tell their teachers or friends that their parents may be undocumented. They can't share that they may be undocumented. We saw this happen with the DACA kids when, you know, for generations, there were people in their own friend circles who didn't know that they didn't have status. And they didn't feel empowered or safe to be able to come forward and say, look, I'm undocumented and I need help, or I'm coping with some issues that come about from the trauma that I have experienced and I need help. You know, I had a therapist, and when I was working on this book, I talked to a lot of people. And one of the therapists told me that trauma is like emotional residue. And I found that to be very profound, because emotional residue isn't just something that you can walk away from just because you get older and get an education. It's there. And so that is why, in this instance, I wanted some way to start at a young age to start to give children a voice so that they didn't feel so isolated, so lonely. And whether it's a school counselor, a school teacher, their own friend circle, to be able to be comfortable to say, look, I'm undocumented. My parents are undocumented. And all of a sudden, it's not taboo to talk about. And we can address some of the issues, the real issues going on. So that was the design behind empowering kids. Also, again, I think when you look at television, you see criminal court in all kinds of television programs. You see family court in all kinds of programs. You don't see immigration court in any programs, not on a realistic level. Immigration court doesn't have juries. Immigration court has one judge. And oftentimes, the judge is looking at the parents' stories and understanding and making decisions on the parent's life without ever really considering what's in the best interest of the child. It's not a marker in immigration jurisprudence. I find that to be bizarre.
You know, and as I was reading through the book and thinking about the title and how you've just explained it, it is interesting to me that vulnerability, and we've talked about this in past shows, vulnerability and recognizing the vulnerability can actually, in and of itself, be a strengthening exercise. And so it would seem like for some children, and this is part of the story, the parents are whispering, the children know something's going on, and I think they would quickly learn, perhaps because they aren't allowed to talk about it, or perhaps they think they're not allowed to, or they don't see their story out there, that it becomes something shameful. And what I see here with the story is wait a minute, this is not something shameful. This is part of your experience, part of your life. Let's address it head on. And there are other people out there just like you going through the exact same thing. And it's nothing to feel shame about.
I think that's a really good observation, because we know that shame unaddressed, and there's obviously, way smarter therapists out there who can address the issue. And I'm, of course, not a therapist, and I only see it in the context of working with clients. But shame unaddressed does manifest, right? It comes through even as an adult. And I think that's what that therapist meant when she said to me that some of these issues are emotional residue. Because we don't, as an adult, if it's left unaddressed, we do see it manifest. We get clients who later on in life will have issues with alcohol. You see it in immigrant communities, right? Alcohol and DUIs are very common in immigrant communities. Why is that? Because after 20 years of living in the shadows and having fear and constantly being in a flight or fight state of mind, I think it does manifest and shows up in different ways that, for the average person, we go, oh, well, why are they doing what they're doing? And we really don't have the skills. I mean, therapists do, but me as a lawyer doesn't have the skill to go, oh, this is the thread that was put in place so long ago.
You know, I was going to ask you, the next question was, why did you choose a young girl? And what was interesting about that is I'm looking at you now on a Zoom call, and we posted something for Facebook and LinkedIn about it, where your picture was juxtapositioned with Alia the Brave. And I couldn't help but notice, and you actually have a shorter haircut now, that perhaps this young girl is you to a certain extent, meaning you see in this young girl some of the experiences that perhaps you went through, not identical, but enough shared experience where you can relate.
You know, I think that for girls, and certainly for, I didn't realize the haircut, though. Thank you for pointing that out. I don't think that was deliberate at all. But no, I think that, for girls, I was lucky. I had a father that, even though he came from a patriarchal society, he was all about empowering women, and he was all about making sure that his daughters never lived in the shadows of submissive expectations of the culture. And he never wanted to do that. And for me, his position was, look, if you can empower a girl child, then you can empower future generations, because that's who's going to be your mother. That's who's going to be your grandmother. That's who's going to be your sister. And for him, rightfully or wrongfully, he said, you know, he wanted his daughters to be able to carry that flag forward, to say, if I empower my daughters, they will grow up to empower other daughters and other people's daughters. And that's kind of where I was tapping into. I really do believe that, especially in immigrant communities, we have a tendency, boys tend to be given the benefit of the doubt that, oh, they're going to be brave. But girls aren't given that ability. And sometimes that visibility and that that representation just doesn't happen.
And, you know, what's interesting about it is in my work with immigrant communities, which is, you know, on the periphery, I've noticed, and this is anecdotal, but I see the pain and the anxiety and the frustration and all of it much more on the faces of the mothers than I do the fathers. And I don't know if that's cultural. I know we're talking about many different cultures, but when I look to the suffering of some of my clients and their families, that suffering manifests itself most, at least as I can tell, in the faces of the women.
They're usually the ones that are left behind to take care of the family, right? If you look at the number of people in immigration court proceedings, the vast majority of them are men. And in much like in Alia's case, right, you had the dad who was taken out of the home. And even if the whole family is undocumented, right? And again, I didn't put those details specifically in to Alia's story because I wanted it to be more broad-based and more universal. And so some of those factors were deliberately kept out because it can be at various points in the proceedings, it can be various forms of relief in immigration court. So I wanted some of that vagueness to be there. But as a general rule, when you look at ICE enforcement, they take the male figure out of the house. And so who's left? And in a lot of instances, you know, mom's not working. She's been a stay at home parent, or they don't have all of the resources now because dad was the breadwinner. And so it creates, and you see that pattern over and over again. And so when you say, well, we've got to empower mom to now be able to deal with and be able to address what's happening and give her the skills, I mean, that is also part of Alia's story.
We're talking today with Rekha Sharper Crawford. She is the author of Alia the Brave, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement. It's a wonderful children's book. I know it is available if people want to buy it on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble. When we come back, we will speak further with Rekha Sharma Crawford about how this book can be used as a tool, not just to work with children, but also to work with families, both in the criminal defense world and in the immigration world. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Let's explore. Let's question. Let's decolonize together on Ebony's Bones.
Tune in every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Play KKFI. That's all you have to tell your smart speaker to get the news, views, and music you love. KKFI can be wherever you are.
National Volunteer Week is an opportunity to recognize the impact of volunteer service and the power of volunteers to tackle society's greatest challenges. At KKFI, we are fortunate to have a group of volunteers who have accepted this challenge, which is expressed by our mission, in part, to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Thank you to all of the volunteers who make KKFI happen. We appreciate everything you do this week and every week of the year.
Now the calendar for the week of April 18th. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants has a monthly virtual meeting. Missouri Cure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri prisons and jails, as well as for those who have returned to society. For information, call Keith Brownell at 816-377-2873. Wednesday, April 20th, 7 p.m., advocacy training with Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Please register. The link is on our webpage or Facebook page. Friday, April 22nd, 11 a.m., Empower Missouri's Criminal Justice Coalition is online. Access at empowermissouri.org. Saturday, April 23rd, 8 a.m., have you registered for Pee Wee's Run, Kansas City Mothers in Charge annual 5K run and walk, beginning at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center. There's still time. More info at Facebook, KC Mothers in Charge. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That list is updated daily. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org, as the Jaws of Justice Facebook page. Stay safe. A crisis on the scale of the pandemic can reorder society in dramatic ways, for better or worse. All of society pays a heavy price for decades of failing to create a rational system of health care that works for all of us. Thanks to our engineer today, Stan Thomas. We now return to our program, David Bell speaking with Rekha Sharma Crawford.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest is Rekha Sharma Crawford, immigration attorney in Kansas City and throughout the country. She has written a fabulous book entitled Aliyah the Brave, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement. It's a children's book. It's written from the perspective of a young girl. And at this point, we're going to talk about how to use this book as a tool to work with clients and their families. You know, but before I begin, I was, during the break, I was asking Rekha, you know, am I pronouncing the name right? And I'm saying Aliyah. So I was raised Jewish, and Aliyah or Aliyah is a term that I would know when I see this, how it's spelled. And of course, Rekha, your response to me was what?
I think it's perfect. That's exactly what it's designed to do. And I think you shared with me, David, the meaning in the Jewish faith, and I thought it was such a beautiful meaning, and it was so consistent with everything this book was designed to do. And so, you know, tell that story again.
Sure. So when someone moves to Israel, it's called they make aliyah, which would be similar to this word, or an aliyah. In like a bar mitzvah, we are called up to the Torah, and those in general means to rise up, to move to higher ground, if you will, in a spiritual sense and also in a physical sense. So it works so beautifully with your book. So I'm a practitioner. I do criminal defense work. I've got this book. I have had young girls like Aliyah in my office representing their parents. How is it that I would use this, or an immigration attorney would use this book to help further my job at helping families?
Yeah, so I think, it's designed for a variety of professions and vocations, but for attorneys in particular, even if you aren't someone who goes into immigration court, there are pages in the book that you can use to have a conversation. So for example, I'm sure there are other, and you see it certainly in the criminal perspective, but also in the family court setting, where there is, they don't talk about what's happening. And there is a page in the book where Aliyah is sitting outside of the kitchen, listening to her mom and her grandmother talk in quiet tones about what's happening. She doesn't understand what's happening. And what it does, though, is it leads to her own feeling of isolation and fear. She doesn't know what's happening, but she knows it's not good. And so she has no way to process what's occurring. And, you know, even if you pull that one page out and you say, okay, look, to the parents, to say, look, they know what's happening. You just have to be able to sit down and talk to them. I think oftentimes when parents are going through the criminal justice system, the domestic court system, or even the immigration court system, they're so focused on what's happening in their lives that they think, oh, if I just protect the child and not talk about it with the child, it's all going to be okay. And I think that realization that, you know, the child knows what's happening in the house, and the lack of communication is creating some of the fear and the isolation, that becomes very tangible just from even just that one page.
And so we use it as a method to help families along, if you will, both for the child, at least to see there is somebody like her on this page that's going through a shared experience. It also seems like I would be able to use this in the capacity of working with witnesses that are children witnesses, because I would think that there would be almost this desire to hide it, if you will, is really expressed well in the book and how we overcome that. But I would think that if I have a witness, particularly a child witness, who is not willing to be forthcoming, that could actually harm my client and the interest that the child would otherwise be able to express if they were able to verbalize those interests.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think you can certainly do that as well. And that's why I think, you know, some of the pieces, and as I said, I literally, everything is very, very deliberate. From every single illustration, and thank God I found the illustrator that I did, who was so patient with me because I was so hyper technical about making sure that every piece of the illustration was accurate. So when you look at, for example, the experience of the family, it's as accurate as I know it from my experiences in dealing with immigrant communities. When you look at the court scenes, it's about as accurate. When you open that up, anybody who does immigration removal defense is going to go, yeah, that's not a state court, that's immigration court. And so to help clients kind of have that perspective of this is what I'm going to expect and this is what's going to happen, and tell, you know, and tell parents, look, if you bring your child in, this is what you're going to expect. There's not a lot of people in immigration courts, usually just the judge, the two attorneys, and the family, right? And so that's very, very accurate with what happens. And you can use that as a way to get clients ready for court.
When you were writing the book, you said you found an illustrator, you were lucky to find an illustrator. Did you also work with other professionals to make sure that you were dealing with trauma in an appropriate fashion?
I did. I had the book edited by a former Disney worker. As I said, I found that when you look at all of the Disney stories that are for kids, right, they do such a profound job on talking about difficult topics and putting it in a way that a child can relate to it. So once I wrote the book, I had it looked at by a Disney editor, and then I had a therapist look at it when I did the illustrations and took in their consideration. So one of the things that the therapist told me is look, make sure that in the illustrations, you never show the parent and law enforcement struggling. Don't, you know, so there should be no handcuffs. There should be no, you know, really scary things that kids may not be able to process. I took that to heart and said, okay, when I do the illustrations, I want to make sure that that is addressed. After the book was written, I had a number of folks that did endorsements, including a guest that I think you're going to be talking to is a trauma doctor from Miami. And she came forward, and she's amazing, and I think your listeners are going to enjoy listening to her, I think, next week. But she did an incredible job just, you know, making sure that there was no harm being done, because that was the number one golden rule is do no harm. And we wanted to make sure that the book didn't have any element that was going to cause trauma to the child further, and yet was going to be a resource that people could use.
And so as we go through the book, I will tell you when I finished it, when I first read it, that I started tearing up. I won't go into how it ends. I'll leave that for the readers to find out. But it's presented in a beautiful way, but yet maybe I'm projecting onto it. a very emotional way as well. Was that your intent?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of it was done in an effort to be very intentional with the message and then with the outcome. And again, I'm not gonna tell people how it ends. I will say that it's a children's book, so just kind of I want to make
it better
sure.
end a certain way.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, as we talk about trauma, Rekha, and I can't help but wonder about the trauma experienced by other individuals in the system, including, for example, as we go back to the Elian Gonzalez example, the trauma of law enforcement pointing the gun at a child. Just like the individual in the New York Times article, it seems like that trauma has to be experienced by more than just the child. We've got the parents, but potentially also the law enforcement. I'm wondering if you've seen any attempts in your work to address that trauma as well.
I mean, I think that's harder. I mean, you know our background. I came out of the district attorney's office. My husband, Michael, was law enforcement for 15 years. And, you know, when we went through this, and I think as much as I am grateful for my illustrator, I'm also grateful for my husband who watched me obsess over this project for so many months. And we talked about some of those things in terms of, you know, how do we portray the law enforcement in the book? And again, deliberately, it's not done to make them nasty or terrible. I mean, I haven't taken that kind of a position. The story is told from the perspective of the child, but by the same token, there was no effort to vilify, if you will, the law enforcement officers that were doing their job.
Well, and I just wonder, you know, one of the things as we've gone through this, the past few years, at least in particular with the border and some of the issues that we've discussed there, it seems to me that trauma, and you talked about it in terms of use of alcohol, but it seems as if trauma that is not processed in a healthy way has to manifest itself somewhere down the line in some manner that we can't even predict. And in addition to the harm caused immediately to the children and to the adults in the immigration system, I'm worried about how that trauma multiplies over time, so that in 30 years or 40 years, we'll be dealing with this if we don't deal with it right now in a healthy manner.
And, you know, I think the issue is that when you look at the immigration laws and as it relates to children in particular, you know, they are considered to be what we call qualifying relatives for a variety of forms of relief for immigration, right? They can, at a certain age, potentially, and I say potentially because the immigration laws are not friendly and neither are they very workable or sustainable. But by the same token, there are ways where in the right set of facts, a child can petition for their parent, a parent can petition for their child. In immigration court, there are certain forms of relief from deportation that require looking at the child and the impact of the deportation on the child. That said, they don't view that through what's in the best interest of the child. And in fact, they don't give that any weight. And unless you have really bad facts where the child is medically disabled or physically disabled or something like that, they don't care. There's three seminal cases that literally have been around for two and a half decades that have not changed at all, even though we know that through the social sciences and other research has shown that there is trauma for these children, that it manifests in a different way. Even though science has taken us further down the path, these three cases are unaltered. And I mean, I really do think that it's time, and back to it's going to require bravery from immigration judges, politicians, the Board of Immigration Appeals, those lawmakers, the Attorney General even, to say, look, these are stale cases and these holdings are stale and no longer consistent with what we know from the science of how this kind of enforcement impacts children. And it's really going to take that effort to say, look, I understand that the law doesn't say we must view this in or we must measure it against the best interest of the child, but to divorce that concept out in its totality from the immigration context, it seems counterintuitive.
So let me understand this, and this is not a topic that I am involved with other than tangentially, that criminal convictions can have consequences in the immigration forum. If we're in the family court in Kansas City, for example, it's in the interest of the child. In fact, the case is actually titled essentially in the interest of the name of the child. And so theoretically, the system is supposed to look at what's in the best interest of the child. Are you telling the listeners of me that in the immigration context, that best interest of the child, for the most part, unless it's some extreme example of this medical need, is not considered at all?
Not at all. In fact, the standard is called exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. Well, I mean, and apparently taking a father out of the household is not exceptional enough. Taking a mother out of the household is not exceptional enough. Destroying a perfectly functioning, healthy family is not exceptional enough. If your kids are thriving, if your family is thriving, that's not exceptional enough. I think that it's counterintuitive, right? I mean, you don't want, and in fact, in the dissent in one of these cases, the board members talk about, they say, look, this doesn't make sense because what you're saying is that a functioning, healthy, loving family doesn't have sufficient value. That is counterintuitive, but yet that posture and that position has been the norm in immigration court for the past two decades. And it just is so counterintuitive that, you know, I agree that the legal standard that Congress has put is exceptional and extremely unusual. But I think for children, that measure must be viewed in the context of what's in the best interest of the child. But you can't divorce the two.
And what I really appreciate about the book and about you is that it's helped me to start going back through the system that I'm in, criminal, but also looking at immigration from afar and saying what trauma is experienced by which participants. And what I found as you've made me think about this, and particularly with your book, is that almost every player or participant in these two systems experiences trauma in some way. And I think the failure to recognize that and the failure to measure that then makes us more likely to fail when we come up with whatever policies we're going to come up with. It may be we decide that 6 a.m. raids on families to take the father figure away is acceptable. I'm not going to make that call right here. But it would seem to me that the failure to recognize the trauma to everybody cannot be the way to go.
Well, I mean, I think that's it, right? I think as an evolving society, our hope is that we learn from science and psychology and make better decisions and have healthier communities, right? I don't think the goal of anybody is to have a dysfunctional, fear-based, unworkable society. I think everyone who is in power would agree, regardless of whether they would agree on air or in a political speech, that it is in the best interest of humanity in the United States that these societies function effectively, that we address some of these needs and issues. I think we can all agree on that on a human level, right? There is a reason why, you know, so many years later, if you say Elian Gonzalez, everyone can pull up that visual. Because we all, it adhered to, at our core, in our DNA, to go, that wasn't right. Right? We could all agree that wasn't right, regardless of the outcome of the case. I'm just saying, if you look at that one image, we say that wasn't right. And so I think that's the same thing here, is this book was designed to start the conversation to say, look, we all recognize what's right and wrong. We all recognize that this is where we want society to land, which is in a healthy spot. And how do we get there? Well, we have to get there by being brave and talking about these issues, addressing these issues, and not just kind of putting them back in the shadows.
And I'm wondering, Rekha, once these issues come out of the shadows, or hopefully come more out of the shadows with your book, what do we do then in terms of helping these children, in particular Aliyah here, process that trauma? Meaning the book helps her recognize that there's other people that are going through similar experiences that she is, and that she needs to be brave. But I'm wondering, and maybe this is, you know, way off into the future, and I know we'll be speaking with other guests later about trauma, but what do you see as the next step after that? We've recognized trauma, we're going to weigh it appropriately, consider it, but now what? What do we do for this child to help them through this experience?
And I think some of those individuals that you're going to speak to, because again, that's not really in my professional arsenal. I can't make the call that says, you know, as a psychologist, this is what should be done or these resources should be available. I don't have the expertise to make those calls. But I think for the first time, you know, if we identify it and we can recognize it and value it, then now we can start to look at, well, then there must be a solution. I mean, if we don't even identify the problem, then we're not looking for a solution. If we identify the problem now as a group of collaborative members of a community, we can start to find a solution.
You know, when I was talking to you about this book prior to today, you had indicated that with some lawyers even, there was a question as, wait a minute, how would I use this book? How would I use this book in my work? And what I found interesting about that is that there was that barrier to thinking through how it could be used. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just like the idea that, wait a minute, this book's about a child. It's about trauma. What would I do with that? And I'm wondering if you could address that kind of blind spot, if you will, that I know some lawyers, including myself, may have when they're faced with a book like this and how it could potentially be useful in their practice.
Well, I mean, you know, innovation is always about what? We don't know what we don't know until we know. And in some ways, this is designed to do exactly that, is that even though the knee-jerk reaction for attorneys is, well, why would I use that? Or maybe I'll just buy a copy and put it in my lobby. And, you know, if the client reads it, the client reads it. I think that isn't necessarily the goal. I think once they read it and say, okay, well, how do I utilize this? How do I use this to open up communication with my client? How do I provide it to my clients so that they can utilize it, so that they can communicate with me? I mean, an attorney-client relationship requires a communication that's both-sided, right? But even if the client doesn't understand how to voice it, or even that there is a problem, you know, we never realize we shut out the kids from the conversation. If the client themselves never realize that they're doing that because that's what they've always grown up with and that's what they've known, or their families and their parents in dealing with any other form of trauma or difficult conversation items excluded the kids. I mean, you know, think about it. How many times have we said, oh, have I been banished to the kids' table? You go to family events and go, oh, I've been banished to the kids' table.
Right.
It's in our DNA, right? We think in terms of isolating the kids. And so the adults are over here having conversations and the kids have been relegated to the kids' table. And I think until we can come look at that and say, we do it swiftly and without even thinking about it. And so the hope is that the book will make people go, wait a minute, let's have this conversation because I do it without even thinking about it. And if I do it out of habit, there's no way for us to overcome it.
The final question I have for you, Rekha, is this. I understand presenting this book to individuals, perhaps families that are in the immigration process, to help them understand shared experiences. But it also seems like it would be helpful to present to children whose parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents were born in the United States. Meaning it would be a way, it seems to me, to help children that wouldn't otherwise be thinking of these issues to maybe be more aware of them. And that may then help them in how they treat their fellow students, the individuals they come across. Is that also something that you're anticipating this book to be used for?
I think it's designed in that context to create empathy and understanding. If we don't understand or we don't relate to someone else's experience, we really can't be empathetic to it. I think part of what immigration as a topic lives on, some of why is it so a divisive topic? It's because there's the empathy has been taken away, yeah. Right? When you think about the issues at the border, people are running for their lives and they're running from civil strife. We can all as a community easily go, yes, that community we recognize and we associate with, but this other community I don't recognize and don't associate with, right? And part of that is because we tend to gravitate to things that are comfortable. And so if it's an experience I'm comfortable with, then I can relate to it and I can be empathetic with it. But if it's an experience that I'm uncomfortable with, or I don't necessarily fully understand that experience, then I'm more likely to simply shut the door and walk away. And so in that regard, my hope is that people will pick up the book and say, okay, I at least now have a window into the understanding of someone else's experience that allows me to create empathy when I am discussing that issue, or when I am trying to find a solution to that issue, or when I see someone struggling with that issue. And I think empathy is something we need more of.
Absolutely. The book is called Aliyah the Brave, Empowering Children Coping with Immigration Enforcement. It's written by Rekha Sharma Crawford, our guest today. Rekha, if one of our listeners wants to purchase the book, where would they go to do that?
You can go on Amazon.com. You can go to BarnesandNoble.com. You can also, if you just Google the name, it will come up. Or if all else fails, you can, and you are brave enough, you can put my name in the thing, which is Rekha Sharma Crawford, all one word, .com. And the book is available there as well.
Rekha, first of all, thank you for being here today. But even more so, thank you for such a beautiful book. It was so heartfelt and so warm, and I just can't thank you enough for putting these experiences on this page to help me better understand even what children are going through.
Well, thank you, David, for taking the time to talk about this, because I think you are at the front of what this book was designed to do, which is to start these conversations, and I thank you for that.
Thank you for being here. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Enjoyed today's show, and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, you can send an email inquiry or comment to kkfi.org/contact. This is Jeff reminding you our outro music is Higher Ground from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with the Law and Disorder on Tuesday. Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musicale.
I'm gonna hold on the best I can.